Chris Graham.
Welcome to Street Knowledge. This is Chris Graham, and I'm in Stanton, Virginia today for a meeting with Cliff Hira. Cliff is running for governor of Virginia. He's the Libertarian candidate on the ballot, so third-party candidate Cliff Hira, and he's running in the polls. Where do you expect a third-party candidate to be sort of in the 3-5% range? There have been a number of polls out this week, actually, in the Virginia race, with the first televised debate. As we're recording this on Wednesday, it was Tuesday night last night, and so some more attention on the race. We're within 6 weeks of Election Day, but Cliff is he's on the ballot. He's certified. He's libertarians have done well in Virginia, you know, again by the comparative standards of third party candidates. Robert Sarvis, the libertarian candidate who ran for governor in 2013, got 7% of the vote actually in that election. And to some degree, I mean, you could look at it depending on who you wanted to say he impacted more, Terry McAuliffe or Ken Cuccinelli, could have impacted certainly Cuccinelli's chances to win that election. But you'll find out that as we talk through this interview, we'll get some opinions at least from Cliff Hira on the value of the third party vote, the potential for him to steal some votes away, and some of his priorities as a candidate for governor. Really interesting interview. I'm recording this open after having just completed the interview, and he's a really smart guy, savvy guy, Virginia Tech grad, George Mason Law, young guy who owns his own law firm, has several partners. He works in law in the Richmond area. Really, really smart, well-spoken man, and I think you'll like this interview. So let's go ahead and get to the interview that I just did with Cliff Hira, running about the his campaign for governor of Virginia. First thing I want to ask, here it is Wednesday. Last night, debate.
Yeah.
Ralph Northam's there. Ed Gillespie's there. I guess you're sort of there, but you're not on the stage.
Right.
Talk about that. I mean, that's got to be frustrating to be on the ballot. And yet not have a place on the stage like that.
It's very frustrating, especially some polling came out recently and they actually asked the question, you know, do you want to see Cliff Hira in the debates? And overwhelmingly the answer was yes. You know, more than two-thirds said yes, only 15% said no. So that seems like the most important criteria is, you know, do people want to see me, want to know what my issues are, my positions are on the issues. And I think most people support the idea of an inclusive debate where everybody who's on the ballot, which is not a trivial feat to be on the ballot, should be represented in the debate because, you know, people want to know about all the options that they have to choose from. They have a very serious decision to make, you know, choosing which candidate to support and trying to decide what policies they should push they think are best for Virginia. And, you know, it's not helping them when a whole, set of ideas is excluded, you know, from the conversation. And I think there's a lot of areas where I could have added, you know, very significantly the things that I like to talk about that I think are really important for Virginia that the other candidates don't like to talk about so much that they avoided. You know, one thing that I noticed really in particular is they spent so much time talking about monuments and they didn't spend any time talking about criminal justice reform. So, you know, and that's something that has a lot of racial aspect to it. But monuments is just, you know, people feel they don't like the monuments, but criminal justice is something that affects people's lives so dramatically in so many ways, and has such a stark, you know, discrepancy between the way that, you know, African Americans and other people are treated, the results that they come up at. So it's very, very disappointing to see that that's not being talked about at all. And, you know, I guess I don't, they're limited in some ways by what's raised, you know, by the moderators, but I certainly would have pivoted from that, and just to see so much time directed towards this sort of insoluble, you know, cultural war issue with the statues, it was, you know, certainly disappointing.
It's TMZ type stuff. I mean,
exactly.
It's nothing substantive that'll affect your actual life.
Right, your material well-being in any way.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, people are just so crazy about it. It's weird. It's a weird issue. I think people have seized upon it. I wonder sometimes, you know, I don't know who it is exactly that's pushing this narrative, but I think because it is a culture war issue, so it drives hits and clicks and things like that. So, you know, it's very divisive and polarizing, and so maybe for the media that's something that's good for them because it attracts attention, you know, and it sells, you know, ads. But, you know, for the people of Virginia, there's a lot of other issues that we could be focusing on that are maybe you know, more important. You know, even though some people feel passionately about the statute.
Even for those candidates too, it's a few minutes where you don't have to talk about substantive issues, right?
Right.
So
right.
Maybe good for them as well, at least in their minds.
Yeah.
First, this is your first run for public office, and you're running for governor as your first run for public office. Talk to me about your decision-making process to make this run.
Right. Well, you know, I think that's something that contributed to my decision to run is that I thought it was a very important race. You know, there's only two statewide elections or gubernatorial elections this year in the entire country. So there's a lot of attention, of course, in this area, but really nationwide. And I thought it was really important for there to be a Libertarian candidate, you know, putting forward the Libertarian, you know, positions. And to maintain some of the momentum that we built up over the last few years with the previous Robert Sarver's campaign in 2013 and the Gary Johnson campaign that I was really happy about, and that, you know, generated a lot of interest, a lot of new party members, a lot of new voters. So I thought it was very important for there to be representation for those people who are third-party voters, independent voters, really fed up with the other parties, and a really great opportunity for me to get out, you know, some of these issues that are important to me, because I think Virginia is really far behind other states in a lot of ways. There's a lot of things that could be improved, you know, it's really important for me to make people aware of some of those things that you know, myself being a lawyer, I'm maybe more aware of some of the legal issues that we have here in Virginia that other people just aren't aware of, and that other politicians don't necessarily like to talk about. So for me, the fact that the office was so important was part of what drew me in. You know, even though I have a lot of other things going on, I have, you know, four children and I have my own law practice and stuff, but it was very important for me to make time for that, and that's pretty much, you know, I'm putting all the time that I have, other than what I have to, you know, I have to keep my job going, I have to keep my family sane, but after that, you know, everything's going into this, and, you know, it's been a really great experience so far. I'm not sure, you know, that I would have the same experience if I was running for a board of supervisors or something like that, you know, I won't roll it out, you know, in the future.
Sure. Using the debate as sort of a jumping off point to ask about, you're sitting talking with me, I'm a member of the media, we're talking about
Sure.
your campaign. How hard has it been to get traction with just the basics of getting coverage, attention to your campaign?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit hard for me to say because I don't handle really that aspect
Sure.
of the campaign. My campaign director has done a really great job, actually, of getting me media. You know, he did some of the communications, you know, media work for the Johnson Weld campaign. So that's kind of in his wheelhouse. And so we have gotten a lot of coverage. I'm sure, you know, nothing compared to the other guys. But even right from the beginning, you know, we've had people covering the campaign. And I think, you know, other people have paved the way for me. So because Robert Sarver had such a serious campaign and got so many votes, and the Johnson Weld campaign, you know, there's such a large number of voters here in Virginia who are interested and do care about the Libertarian candidate, that's made it easier. So, you know, I've been happy with it. You know, I'm sure that we can always do better, and that, you know, there's a lot more interest in the other guys. But, you know, I've been pretty happy with that side of the campaign. You know, the number of stories and stuff that have been run about.
I'd like to think that we're a more educated society now than maybe, you know, so that the word libertarian doesn't make people think, what is a libertarian?
They're not thinking of libraries so much, yeah,
right.
These days.
But do you run into that when you talk with voters out on the trail, at least to some degree?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. We still have a lot of work to do. I mean, you know, at one time, I think a lot of libertarian candidates were pulling under 1%. You know, now we're generally doing at least 3 or 4%. So that's a big increase, but it's still a small number. So, and when you look at the polling, that's one number that jumps out at me is, and, you know, they ask, well, what's your opinion of this candidate? Is it favorable, disfavorable? And still for me, you're seeing in the 80s, you know, 80% plus of people don't have enough information about me to form an opinion. So it's certainly, you know, a real challenge getting the message out. And we absolutely run into people who say, you know, what is a libertarian? You know, you're an independent, or you have to explain to them, you know, kind of what it is. And I think there's a lot of people who are in the Libertarian Party, and they say, oh yeah, you know, after someone explained to me what it was, I realized I was a libertarian, you know. So we definitely have a lot of work to do, and we're, you know, we've got a lot of great volunteers and people, you know, who are working to do exactly that, just to get the message out there, make sure everyone's aware of who we are and what kind of, you know, positions we have, and of course, ourselves specifically as a candidate, not just as a libertarian. So that people who feel the same way that we do, you know that they have a home.
Painting with a wide brush, libertarian, I mean, you know, and just like Democrats and Republicans, a label means something and individuals within it can differ. But socially, somewhat liberal, fiscally conservative, right?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, that's the core.
Where do you fall on both of those sides of the XY axis, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I consider myself a very mainstream libertarian. Uh-huh. So that means that I'm really quite centrist, I would say. So I would say, you know, on social issues, yeah, I'm very inclusive. I mean, I'm very pro-immigration. I'm, you know, pro-tolerance, you know, anti-discrimination and stuff. You know, one thing I'm looking for is to end, you know, any discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity in state employment, you know, decisions. And, you know, there's some other places in the Virginia law where we still haven't updated subsequent to the Supreme Court decisions, you know, to provide a fully, you know, level field for, you know, civil partnerships, civil unions, and gay marriage. So on all those kinds of issues, I'm you know, my position is, right, in my personal life, I'm maybe more conservative, you know. I'm not doing drugs, you know, or you know, well, I just happen to have been born, right, heterosexual and so forth. But I might not encourage people to do that, but at the same time, I'm very reluctant to, you know, put anyone in a cage for something that they're doing in their own private lives that isn't really affecting anybody else. So sure. That's certainly the core of my beliefs, respect for, you know, every human being and their equal dignity and their right to equality under the law, and some respect for their ability to make their own decisions about their own lives, even if I disagree, you know, with what those decisions are. And then fiscal issues, you know, I'm pretty conservative, you know. I mean, I think that spending should go down and taxes should be lower. You know, I'm very interested in economics. And I've had some exposure to economics. You know, I went to law school at George Mason, and they have a pretty well-known economics department, and there's some integration of the law school and the economics department. You know, they have law and economics courses and things of that nature, and so that's really when I became interested in economics, and I think it's, you know, professional economists are much more libertarian than the average population. If you look in academy, most academics are very left-wing, and in economics, it's about equal split, sort of left-wing and libertarian. So there's a wide consensus, you know, among sort of, I guess, the experts that libertarian, you know, policies in the economic arena are what's sort of best, you know. So it's not just philosophy, ethical philosophy, but, you know, I really think it will achieve the best results for everybody, maximize welfare. There's, of course, just like any philosophy, there's extremists, and, you know, I think because the party is not so successful in winning elections to date, it tends to siphon off some of the people who are more mainstream to the parties that are winning elections, and so maybe we have more of a reputation as being extremists, but I think there's a large group of libertarians who are not, you know. So you may hear about people who be like, well, we want to privatize all the roads, you know, and we're minarchists, and, you know, government should be doing nothing, and you know, I'm not of that persuasion. I'm more of an incrementalist. So my feeling is we need more freedom, more choice, more competition, and let's always be moving in that direction. So, you know, is, you know, anarchism the best the system? I'm totally agnostic about that. I am skeptical. You know, it seems maybe unlikely, but, maybe it would turn out that way, but we're so far away from that. You know, I mean, that would be like a really radical experiment. So I'm not into radical libertarian experiments. I just really looking to adopt sort of best practices that have already been proven in other places, just bring them here to Virginia, you know, and improve the lives of all Virginians.
It would seem to me like, you know, and I've thought about this a lot, and now I'm going to ask you,
yeah,
both on the social issues and fiscal issues, it's sort of, does government just kind of stay out of my life, basically?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's sort of a
absolutely
way to boil that down, right?
I mean, it's consistent. It really is. There's a consistency there, which
whereas
is,
the two parties,
they're
don't,
not
aren't consistent, right? Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So, if you look at it as a coherent philosophy, you know, there really is a philosophy there, which is the philosophy of maximizing individual freedom and individual rights, and you know, generally when you're when government does more, it tends to infringe on, right, the rights of the individual, because there's a government that's coercing you, it's telling you what to do. So, you know, we believe in less government interference in the economic sector and in the private, in the personal, in the social sector. Whereas, right, the other two parties, it's not really a natural division. I mean, you see in other countries, they're not divided in that way. And it's more of just a tribal thing. Well, like, I identify with other people who are in this party. You know, not to paint with too broad of a brush. I mean, people land where they land based on their assessment of which one is, I guess, closest to the way that they feel. But, yeah, there's no, inherent logic to, I think, the positions, you know, the group of positions that's adopted by the other parties.
Yeah, on both sides of the mainstream. Yeah. I'm thinking of something you said earlier. If more people just knew what libertarians stood for, you know, on social issues and fiscal issues, I think, you know, when it's explained to them, maybe they think, oh, you know, actually I might be a libertarian.
Right.
That seems to be the battle, maybe to some degree, for you and for others in the party, is to maybe make people realize what libertarians stand for and maybe make them realize that, yeah,
right,
you're more like us than you realize.
Yeah, I think there's two battles, you know. There's two parts to it. One is, yes, educating people and just making sure they're aware that there's a third option and, you know, what we stand for. And there's a very substantial portion of the population, you know, based on polling data, that agrees with us on the majority of the positions, you know, maybe as high as 20% or so at least, who are fiscally conservative and socially inclusive, tolerant. But there's another side of that, which is that it's a two-party system, you know, and it's really very difficult for any other party to break in, especially in Virginia. You know, a lot of other states are more lenient with their major party status. The Libertarian Party now has major party status in 37 states, thanks to primarily the Johnson-Weld campaign. So typically the way it works is if you can get, you know, 2% of the vote or so in a statewide election, you become a major party, and then you automatically have ballot access for every race for a certain period of time. But in Virginia, that's 10% you have to get. So it's one of the very highest, I think one of the three highest in the entire country for the threshold. So it's a very high threshold. So we have to go out and gather a lot of petition signatures to get anybody on the ballot for any race. And it makes it more difficult. You know, we gathered over 15,000 signatures, you know, for the governor race, and it costs a lot of money and a lot of time and effort. The other parties don't have to do that.
Right.
What we'd love to do is we'd love to contest every race. Be on the ballot for every House of Delegates election. You know, there's lots of elections that are uncontested, you know, 60% plus usually in most years, a little bit better this year, but usually 60% plus of the House of Delegates races are uncontested, so people have no choice.
Right.
You just have the incumbent and nobody else. And we're especially well suited to contest those elections because we're in between the other two guys. So in a race where maybe, you know, the Republican or the Democrat would be uncompetitive because it's so much that district isn't so much in the other direction, we could be competitive. So we would love to be offering people a choice, and I think by being on the ballot and having our candidates out there, you know, that would facilitate that first goal of educating people and making sure people know who we are, you know. But it would be a lot easier if we could get some reform on the political side, you know, if we could reduce that requirement of, you know, the percentage of vote that we have to get. If we could maybe move to a system of voting that's maybe ranked choice voting, because right now we have what's called first past the post. And so a lot of people's complaint, a lot of people's reasons why they don't want to vote for us is they're afraid that will make their second choice lose.
Yes.
And so lots of people complain about that and accuse me of throwing the race to one side or the other, but not a lot of people are then willing to support ranked choice voting, which is just the idea that if your first choice is clearly not going to win after the first count, well, then your vote moves down to your second choice. So in that way, people can be assured that they can vote for who they think is the best candidate without worrying about it throwing the election to somebody else. So that's a system that's widely used in other countries. It's been adopted recently in Maine. But of course, we don't have it here in Virginia. I think it would be a great change. And of course, we don't have referendums either in Virginia. And that's how it was adopted in Maine, by referendum. So maybe, you know, the first stage of political reform would be getting some form of referendum process here in Virginia, even if it requires a very high number of signatures, at least we'd have the potential. And that's something that, you know, it we want more competition everywhere, including in the political arena. And it's something where we'd see immediate benefits. I know one of my, of course, big things is reforming the drug laws. And it's crazy because we have such high support for that. Over 85% of Virginians support some form of legal marijuana. So if we had referendums, we'd have that already, you know, but we can't get it, haven't been able to get it yet, because there's, you know, there's a few powerful Republican legislators who sit in these, you know, justice, committees, and they can just strangle it without a vote every year.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So there's sort of two things I think at a meta level that we're trying to do in the Libertarian Party. One is spread the message, inform people, educate people, and the other one is some kind of reform to the political process. And those are the two things I think that we need to see sustained higher levels of success.
Looking at the poll numbers of the last couple of days that have come out, everybody wanted to rush their polls out before the debate came up last night. I'll throw the one out that had, it must have assigned everybody to a candidate,
okay,
because it was like 95% of people had already decided. And
interesting.
I'm not sensing that, but the one I think had it 44-39-3, and I do the math on that, and it tells me 15-18% somewhere in that range is undecided.
Right.
That's territory for you to maybe make inroads, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one thing that we've consistently seen so far, is that there's still a large number of undecideds. And I think those undecideds tend to be more third party type voters, because they might go for either of the three any of the three candidates. My support, my base is in among third party voters and independents. I've seen in polls where my support's as high as 16-18% among third party voters. So that presents a real opportunity for me, a real pool of voters to tap into, to potentially increase the percentage of the vote that I'm polling at so far. And we're running out of time. So our big thing that we're pushing for is to try to get some advertising and things like that out there in front of people, so that people who maybe don't read traditional media, we're trying to get exposure in every different type of media, in the radio, potentially on TV, on the internet, so that we can reach as many people as possible.
Mm-hmm. Let's think ahead. Cliff Hiver is elected governor.
Yep.
What is your first priority or first priorities January of 2018?
Right. Well, I would probably start with the things that I could do independently of the legislature. So there's a lot of things where, I would have to work with the legislature to accomplish, my objectives. But the governor has a lot of power in Virginia, has a lot of power over the budget process, but especially they have a lot of power over enforcement of the laws, law enforcement, and of course they have the pardon powers, exclusively the power of the executive in Virginia. So my first order of business would be to making some change to the way the drug laws are enforced, and to the people who are incarcerated in Virginia. So I would immediately order that enforcement of marijuana prohibition be given the lowest possible priority. And if I see that people are still being incarcerated only for marijuana possession, which there's a huge number of people who are, then that would indicate to me that we have too many law enforcement resources, and that those resources need to be redirected somewhere else where they're more useful. Because money that's spent on incarcerating somebody for using marijuana is not only wasted money, it's actually counterproductive. It's making things worse. It's ruining people's lives for absolutely no benefit. So I would give marijuana enforcement the lowest possible prohibition. I would generally deprioritize enforcement of laws against drug use. I would immediately start pardoning people who are in prison only for drug use.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I don't believe that there's any, we're gaining anything by having them in there. It's $30,000 a year to incarcerate one person. And I would give them, if they're only there for drug use, the last place they need to be is in prison, exposed to, violent prisoners and abuse and getting a criminal record. I would give them an absolute pardon to get them out of the prison, back to their families, potentially back to their jobs. By giving them an absolute pardon, it would also take that conviction off of their record and enable them to be employed again.
Which is important. So, they can't start their lives over if they've got that hanging over them, certainly.
Exactly. It's very difficult to get employed, especially to get, a professional, a good job, if you have a criminal conviction on your record.
One issue I wanted to get into, here we are in Stanton, we're surrounded by plans that have impact in terms of the pipelines that have been proposed.
Yeah.
Your position on that, and really, it seems like to me, clearly, both parties have their hands dirty on this issue.
Right.
Governor McAuliffe certainly does. Republicans and Democrats in the legislature and Congress both do. Your thoughts on how to proceed on that issue?
I'm really disgusted by how, the pipelines have carried out What I'm concerned with is that they may try to rush it through even before the election, because they don't want the new governor to have to make or be able to make a decision on it. You know, in Virginia, we made a decision. There was a recent Supreme Court case, Kelo, in 2005, which was, you know, highly controversial, where basically the Supreme Court upheld the right of the federal government to take private property, not for public use, but to give to private companies with the theory that, well, the public will have some ancillary benefit. Maybe they'll have cheaper energy, or they'll have, you know, some additional tax revenue or something of that nature. Now, Virginia made the correct decision to reform our eminent domain laws. You know, we enacted very strong reforms that the government can take private property only for public use. So that's, you know, a public road that anybody can drive on, things of that nature, public parks, public schools. It absolutely does not include pipelines. And my constitutional law professor at George Mason University, Ilya Somin, is one of the, you know, legal experts in the area of eminent domain. He wrote a book, actually, on Kelo. And he agrees that the pipelines are absolutely not a public use. Of course, because it's the federal government that's taking the land, Virginia sort of, you know, can't outright reject that. They can't say, well, you can't do that. But the role for Virginia is to do an environmental review. And, you know, my understanding is that, you know, we're making things easy for Dominion, because Dominion is very powerful in Virginia. They employ a huge number of people. They give huge campaign contributions to everybody except me. So, you know, they have a huge incentive to make things easy for Dominion, and, you know, they're really not doing a thorough environmental process. They're not doing the normal review that's, you know, following the letter of the law here in Virginia. And my perspective is that we should be resisting this federal abuse of the eminent domain power very strongly. We should be protesting it. Nobody's protesting it. Nobody even wants to talk about it. And we should be saying, hey, if you want to do business in Virginia, we expect you to comply with the Virginia law. And, you know, if you're not going to comply with Virginia eminent domain law, then we expect you to comply with the most exacting, you know, environmental standards according to the exact letter of Virginia law. You know, we expect you to put the pipelines where it's most convenient for Virginians, not what's most convenient for Dominion. You know, put it in the places that, you know, is going to cause the most the very least disruption, you know, to Virginians for sure, and the very least, you know, negative consequences, and make sure that, you know, Dominion, or of course in the case of MVP, the other companies who are involved, that they're fully responsible for, you know, any negative outcomes from that work, be the environmental or otherwise, you know, damage to other utilities, things of that nature. So that's my perspective, is that we're going really easy on Dominion, and, you know, it's easy to hide behind, well, there's nothing we can do about it, but there absolutely is something we can do about it, and we should be doing more to protest it and to ensure that if it happens, you know, it's done absolutely according to our strictest standards and not according to what Dominion wants to do, you know, just because they're, you know, politically powerful here in Virginia.
Maybe a last question here. I think we're within 6 weeks of Election Day. I think we're at least the clock is ticking in that direction. What are the next few weeks like for you? I'm sure it's already been crazy the last few months getting your word out there, but it only ratchets up in intensity, I assume.
Right. Everybody's paying attention now. Everybody wants to see me. They want to, you know, interview me, you know, because people are finally like, oh, the election's coming up. I need to make a decision, you know. So it wasn't like that so much in the past. So I have a lot of, you know, events that people want me to attend and so forth. So it's just going to be, you know, a whirlwind of, you know, driving from one place to another. And I'm fortunate to be based out in the Richmond area. So it's kind of, there's a lot of places that are equidistant, you know, from me. It's not impossible for me to drive there, drive back, you know, in the same day. So I have, you know, a whole bunch of events planned all over the state. And like I said, we're working on some ads and some videos and things like that together with some local business owners. And it's just right now that people are paying attention, trying to get myself in front of people's eyes everywhere in Virginia, you know, as many people as I can. Everywhere, and you know, I'm looking forward to it. It's really enjoyable. I mean, it wears me out, and I'm sure, you know, by the end I'll be exhausted. But it's a lot of fun. One thing that I really enjoy is seeing parts of Virginia that I haven't seen before, even though I've lived here my whole life, and you know, meeting new people and getting to learn sort of about their lives and things that are important to them. So, you know, I think it'll be a lot of fun and a lot of work, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thanks for yours.
Stop this right.